Good afternoon, and welcome to the Kaiser Family Foundation's webcast series, U.S. Global Health Policy in Focus. We're coming to you live from our broadcast studio in Washington, D.C. I'm Jen Cates, Vice President of the Kaiser Family Foundation. In Focus brings you discussions and takes your questions about current issues and debates concerning the U.S. government's role in global health. Each live webcast features leaders in their field sharing their views and experiences. Today, we are very pleased to have an expert panel to discuss recent changes and funding challenges at the Global Fund to fight AIDS, TB, and malaria, and the implications for U.S. global health policy. Over the past year, the Global Fund has adopted a new strategy, approved a transformation plan incorporating recommendations from a recent independent review, appointed a general manager who has already begun implementing this transformation plan, and temporarily halted funding of new programs due to financial constraints. What specific changes are being made and why? What are the funding challenges? How will these impact the Global Fund's efforts to address HIV, TB, and malaria, and what does this all mean for the U.S.? Here to talk about these issues are four experts. Joanne Carter, Executive Director of Results and Results Educational Development Fund, Steve Morrison, Senior Vice President and Director of the Global Health Policy Center at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, Shepard Smith, President and Founder of the Institute for Youth Development, and Todd Summers, an Independent Consultant and Chair of the Strategy, Investment, and Impact Committee at the Global Fund. Welcome to all of you, and thank you very much for being here. And to our audience, today's conversation is a live webcast, and we encourage you to submit your questions to us along the way by emailing or via Twitter using the hashtag KFFInFocus. I'll be monitoring questions as we go. I'd like to start by, setting the stage a little bit and going to our panel. Thinking about the Global Fund, it's emerged as one of the leading global health financing institutions in the world, which is a pretty remarkable thing to think about since it was just created a decade ago, and here we are. So it's what happens with the Global Fund today and in the future stands to affect millions of people, and that's why its status and what's going on with it is so important to look at, and all of the changes that I mentioned earlier. And at the same time, the U.S. government itself, with its HIV program and its TB and malaria efforts, is also undergoing some changes. Right now, the U.S. response with PEPFAR is transitioning from an emergency to a more sustainable one. The U.S. government and others are talking about an AIDS-free generation. We're in the midst of a budget environment that's very different than we've seen in the past. And with the most recent budget request, the president has actually signaled a reallocation of funding from bilateral to multilateral. All of this is happening, and it's led to some apprehension among some excitement among others. It's really an interesting time to think about this. So that's the background context, and I'm hoping that we can add some clarity to that and think through what it might all mean. And I'm going to start with Todd, who will, in some concise way, tell us what are the big things that have changed in the last year? I mean, what happened? Why was there an independent review? There's a general manager now. What were some of the funding challenges? Kind of set the stage for us as to where are we right now and based on what has just occurred.
Sure. Well, the question is what's changed, and I think the more appropriate question is what hasn't changed, because I think the Global Fund has been under a significant amount of pressure lately and going through quite tumultuous changes at all levels of the organization. We have a new 5-year strategy that the board approved last November. That's strong, that charts a very important new direction for the Global Fund, requires very substantial changes in the way that it does business in almost every aspect, has an increased focus on making sure that the money is spent more smartly, recognizing that limited resources mean you have to do better with what you have, spends a lot more time on making sure that once the money gets to countries that there's a lot more partnership to make the money work. Recognize that the Global Fund has a critical role in human rights and just reiterates its importance in raising resources from donors, both new and traditional, to maximize the efforts in the countries. I think the strategy is really a guidepost. Now the hard work ahead is to actually figure out how do you take that paper and turn it into a very different way of doing business day in and day out. And certainly how to change the partnership with PEPFAR and the President's Malaria Initiative is a key component of that, because in most of the highest impact countries, PEPFAR and the Global Fund are operating side by side and are by far the largest donors. You've seen a lot of changes in the Secretariat. You mentioned the new general manager. That's an interim step while we're searching for a new executive director. That search is now underway. There's actually a hope that we conclude it by this September, which should be exciting. So that's going to be a big change. But while that's been happening, the general manager came in and made very strong changes in the secretariat. A lot of people had jobs disappear underneath them. A lot of people's job descriptions changed. So some people left, some people stayed, but in different positions. A lot more people were moved into grant management than in other aspects of the Global Fund's operations. The economic environment has certainly changed. It was just last year that the Global Fund Board had to cancel a pending funding round. And now we have some glimmer of hope that the situation is better than we may have thought. We're still trying to come to grips with exactly what the financial forecast is, given increased volatility with donors. But I think we have a slightly better picture that we'll be able to actually put money against increasing efforts rather than just kind of holding level with what we're doing. Probably the most important change is actually not the Global Fund. It's about the diseases themselves. I think we see tremendous opportunities to really make a big difference and to change forever the trajectory of three of the most deadly epidemics that we have. And that comes from a variety of angles. We have, I think, a new understanding and appreciation for how expanding access to AIDS treatment not only helps to save lives but helps to prevent future infections. I think that's a great opportunity. In tuberculosis, we have some new diagnostics, I think, that are going to really help us to find people that are having drug-resistant TB and just diagnosing TB earlier in patients that are harder to find otherwise. And in malaria, we have really done a good job of expanding access to bed nets. We now have these new rapid diagnostic tests for malaria that allow you on the spot to determine whether or not a person, particularly a child, actually has malaria. And so we have to figure out how to get these diagnostics out, how to use them, and how to ensure that when we have a diagnosis, if it is malaria, that they get the proper treatment, and if it isn't malaria, that they get the proper treatment for whatever it is that they do have. So the diseases themselves present us with, you know, just a tremendous opportunity now if we can convince donors to come back to the table in force and convince them that the Global Fund and PEPFAR and PMI remain important strategic investments for taxpayers, particularly U.S. taxpayers.
One follow-up question before I go to Joanne. I wanted to ask Joanne a little bit about what impact the Global Fund has already had and what's unique or different or what are its core strengths and things that might set it apart from other things. One follow-up question that I know has come up when people hear about all these changes, you know, what's been done to ensure that things on the ground are continued at the same time? You know, when you change a major organization like that that's in charge of financing the delivery of services in 150 countries, how does that disrupt or how are things put in place to make sure it didn't disrupt that?
Well, the board, when it canceled round 11, which happened last fall, also put in place a transitional financing mechanism that allowed countries to come to the Global Fund and seek financing just to hold programs level to protect the gains that have been made over the past decade and ensure that while we were trying to figure out the financial situation, we weren't going backwards. Proposals have now been received, and they're actually literally under review as we speak by the independent technical review panel. The good news is that the financial forecasts that we've received show that we can probably fund all of those proposals. So we're now just waiting to see what the TRP, the technical review panel, recommends, but I think we're going to be able to finance those. That gives us a little bit of breathing room and gives countries some breathing room. But still in all, you know, countries were moving forward, and we've asked them now to put the brakes on. So, you know, changing direction yet again and saying, okay, take the brakes off and go forward, but we're not sure how fast, you know, is a real challenge when you're trying to mount programs that are incredibly complex and that put people's lives literally in the balance.
Thanks. Joanne, I want to turn to you, and please pick up on those if you want. I also would be interested to hear your perspectives on what the Global Fund has done, why is it different? It certainly has some core strengths that maybe a bilateral donor might not have on its own, or maybe there's other things about it that make it less able to do things that a bilateral entity might be able to do. So.
Sure, and maybe important to start with, and you know, a little bit building on, Todd, what you've been talking about, but there's the what that's interesting, and then I think the how. But I think in a sort of evidence-based way of looking at Global Fund strengths and weaknesses, the most important should be like what it's accomplished or helped accomplish, right? So one is, you know, working with partners, saving over 6 million lives, you know, being funding 3.3 million people on AIDS treatment, having treated over almost 9 million people for tuberculosis, you know, being key to this massive scale up of bed nets, you know, and other malaria treatments and prevention that, you know, I think none of us, frankly, even 5 years ago, would have maybe predicted, maybe a few, but most of us wouldn't have seen the kind of rapid impact we've had on the malaria epidemic and the reductions in mortality. I can also speak, you know, the piece that probably gets the least attention is tuberculosis, but I've worked on that as an advocate for over 15 years, and it really wasn't until the Global Fund was available that countries had any capacity to do scale-up. You know, BRAC, the Bangladesh Rural Advancement Committee, biggest NGO in the world and one of the best, had been trying to scale up TB treatment in Bangladesh for like 15 years because they actually found it was the biggest reason their microloan borrowers couldn't pay back their loans. So huge issues in Asia. And it wasn't until the Global Fund came along that they were able to take that up. And they're now covering more than half the country with the government doing the other half. So that's the kind of thing that the Global Fund's made possible, clearly with partners, you know, with PEPFAR, with PMI, with others. But I think the other piece, and I think it's so important in a moment when we're talking about things that we need to fix at the Global Fund or reform, to also say that there's some really important core strengths and that we actually need to hold on to those. And I think it's really important that the strategy is kind of built on that. So to me, it's that it's a country-led process. I mean, yes, you want to inform it better, but country-led process, that it's a multi-stakeholder process, that, you know, the Global Fund, as imperfect as some of these country coordinating mechanisms have been, I've had colleagues tell me in so many countries that it was the Global Fund that the fact that all the stakeholders had to be around the table and sign off on a proposal that forced the government to sit down with other country partners in a way that had never happened before in countries. So this country coordinating process, the fact that it's been demand driven, do we have to kind of test that demand and make sure that it's smart? Yes. But the fact that countries could be rewarded for being ambitious in terms of scale up and that we could do that. And that I think at this moment we're also thinking about how to increase the impact of the Global Fund. The fact that it's been a global response, it's actually been a way for the U.S. not only to leverage its resources by bringing in other donors on these programs, but also to kind of increase its reach. Because while PEPFAR may be focused on a really important core set of countries, through the Global Fund, we're able to, you know, be engaged in supporting programs and leveraging, you know, really important responses to all three epidemics in a whole bunch of countries where we're not working directly. So I think all of those things have been really important in terms of the Global Fund's response, and we need to really hold on to those and not kind of, to use a cliche, really throw out the baby with the bathwater as we're trying to strengthen it and reform it.
I want to bring Stephen Shepherd into this. Steve, you and Todd actually recently wrote a paper about what's going on with the Global Fund in the past year called Writing the Global Fund. And in that paper, you pointed out a lot of these challenges and some ideas for what could be done to address these challenges. I'd say when you read it, you can take away either this is a positive outlook or a negative outlook. I mean, it's a little bit of both in the sense of it's a precarious position. So I'd love for you to talk a little bit about that based on also what you heard. I mean, stepping back a little bit, these are almost like the details that people working more closely know about. But what's the perception, you know, the international community's perception now, the donors? Are these reforms getting traction, do you think, is one question. And one of the things I wanted to put out there, and then I'm going to have some questions for Shepherd, is if you read some of the most recent reporting out of the Global Fund by the general manager as he's trying to address these changes, he talks about something interesting, which is that the Global Fund, in his view, to some extent, had become another Geneva UN-focused, inwardly focused organization, and forgot that maybe a little bit that its customer was people in countries. And it sounds like a lot of the cultural shifts as well as some of the reorg is to get back to that. So I'm just putting those out there. I'd love to hear your views on them. And then, Shepherd, I'm going to turn to you more on the involvement of the community and NGOs.
Okay, great. Thank you. Let me hit on a couple of the big pieces. On the staff restructuring, I think the general manager, Jaramillo, moved ahead with extraordinary speed and scope. Mm-hmm. And this is a very exceptional moment. Mm-hmm. The realignment of staff, the buyout of 110 or 120 staff, the reorganization into these three teams focused upon 20 focus countries, the communications, performance standards, personnel, the scope and depth of those changes are profound, and they're moving at a remarkable speed. The fact that he was able to credibly show up in April, scarcely 60 days into his job, and make a very credible case to Congress and to the administration was directly linked to Congress turning around and in the House and Senate appropriations making also remarkable commitments. The House coming in at $1.3 billion, Senate at $1.65 billion. This is pretty unusual phenomenon. So the way in which he's going about this is directly tied to sustaining a very exceptional level of support within Congress and the administration. There's a lot of work still to be done on the restructuring in terms of completion of this, changing of the culture within the organization. That's not complete, but they've made very fast progress on that. The funding model is the other big change that has to be affected, and I know Todd's very integral to that. That funding model is still to be refined and put in place, but they're moving out of the rounds. They're moving towards something that is going to be much more tough-minded, much more selective, something that is going to put a focus upon the fact that resources are far less than demand, and there has to be prioritization and a more tough-minded approach in the allocation of monies. And the Secretariat is going to be charged with being a lead element on that, and it begs the question of whether the board will be up to the task of living with this and supporting this, or whether the board will have great problems and balk and have the political pressures and incentives to micromanage and overturn or thwart some of this. And that is still to be proven and seen. The other thing I would say in terms of big outstanding issues is the whole funding point. The fund has $8 billion to do the phase two renewals and to do the emergency transition mechanism. That's supposed to be an 18-month program. They tightened up their cost projections. They brought in some new talent. They're still recruiting a new CFO. But the reality is that the Eurozone, the EU member states, are in the midst of a crisis around the euro and a crisis around the union itself. And it's worsening day by day, and it's moving from marginal states to core states. And no one knows where that's going to go. And that scale of crisis is eating away at ODA, at Overseas Development Assistance. And it creates enormous softness and uncertainty around what is the funding stream. The U.S. is looking very promising. The European member state budgets are looking extremely soft and uncertain. And what is that going to mean looking forward? And no one's defined yet what a realistic and feasible funding stream is going to look like over the next couple of years, because nobody can quite do that. Mm-hmm. And so this is an organization that's going to be righting itself and getting back up on its feet with a new management and a new infrastructure and a very tough funding situation where it may have to basically deal with much more modest levels than expectations were set at recently. And it's going to have to manage its board and its constituencies to regain its credibility and renew those fundings, but on a much more modest scale potentially than what people would hope for, because the circumstances are so tough.
I think you brought up something. We actually got a question about this from somebody at the Pacific Friends of the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, TB, and Malaria about the Eurozone crisis and the European ODA, and what does that mean for the future of the Global Fund? I mean, if you read the most recent report, it's much more optimistic, but it has a cautionary note. This is an optimistic outlook. It's not – nothing's a done deal. And so that's really good, laying out some of those challenges that I'm sure we're going to come back to. I want to turn to Shepard because
– one small technical point, which is that the European donors are connected to the U.S. contribution because, at least under current law, the U.S. cannot be any more than one-third of what's in. So if Europe slows down – that could hold back, even if the U.S. appropriates a significant amount of money. Mm-hmm. The other thing I just – and we can get into this more after Shepard's have a chance to connect in. But I think talking about this whole tension between sort of allocating scarce resources and trying to support a demand-based effort, which has been what's, as Joanne said, one of the strengths of the Global Fund – you know, we have to figure out how to spend the money smartly, but also communicate that there's still a substantial amount of work left to do. There's still a lot of people with AIDS who are not getting treatment, a lot of people with TB and increasingly MDR-TB who are not getting appropriately diagnosed and treated. a lot of problems still with malaria that we have to deal with. So I, you know, there is this tension between kind of being smart and thoughtful and not overly optimistic. At the same time, we have to still be daring in a way about how we want to respond to the opportunities that are in front of us with these diseases.
And maybe just because, you know, on this point about, and I'm not, you know, I think that there are obviously huge financial challenges, but I have a much more, I mean, just looking at the actual numbers, I actually have a much more optimistic picture. I mean, if there's a Eurozone, you know, increase in crisis, it's going to affect, obviously it's going to affect the Global Fund and ODA, but lots of other things too. So, I mean, that's something to balance. But if you look at, you know, this sort of unprecedented increases for U.S. funding, I mean, I think that's really exciting with bipartisan support. The fact that Japan, post-earthquake, tsunami, and nuclear crisis, actually met its pledge for 2011 and 2012 and, in fact, did it early. The fact that the U.K. is talking about doubling its contribution, they've said that publicly. It's sort of, we're waiting to see when, and hopefully it might be this fall. And that, yeah, while there's sort of no assumption that, you know, Spain or Italy are going to be able to do anything, though they are in discussions with them, I mean, in fact, things have really stabilized well in Germany. Like I said, seeing, you know, positive signals from the Netherlands again stabilized. And even with France, with, you know, some of the challenges, they've been hugely involved in the whole strategic process. And so I think in many ways, if there isn't a huge collapse, I actually think it's a much more positive view, which is not, I think, the different challenge we face, which is the one you both have pointed to, which is that the opportunities of this moment are outstripping resources.
Right. So let's look at these questions from a little bit of a different perspective, which is the ground perspective, working as an NGO in the field, which you've been doing for many, many years with your organization and with partners. What has been your experience of the Global Fund, your interactions with it, and also with some of these changes, what do you think it needs to do to moving forward?
Right. Well, first, it's good to see major reform occurring because it's so needed. I'm just surprised it took so long to happen. The first red flags were raised by the GAO in 2003, I think again in 2007. But when you're in the field watching these programs, and we can compare PEPFAR to the Global Fund in virtually every country we're in, the difference is just so remarkable. PEPFAR is well-run, well-managed. The Global Fund is generally not anywhere near it in quality. The oversight in respect to programs is lacking in the field, and that really needs to be part of this reform effort. The whole mechanism of setting up through CCMs has largely locked out the faith community in many countries. The faith community contributes, by the World Health Organization study, somewhere between 30 and 70% of healthcare, and yet the Global Fund's only giving 4.2% of its money to the faith community. But beyond that, we don't see it embracing the faith community as a legitimate partner in many countries that we're in, where they're actually doing more work than nearly anyone else to help people affected by HIV/AIDS. And so for those of us who really want to maximize dollars, who really want to see, and I think everybody here does, want to help as many people as possible, but are out there doing it day in and day out, the reforms needed for the Global Fund are dramatic. And it can't come soon enough, and it has to even be broader than it is from our perspective on the ground.
Mm-hmm. I want to sort of check in on this comment. It was actually a question to Steve, I think, but you brought it up a little bit, which is the UN-like approach of the Global Fund. And I think that we've seen that in a couple of ways. One is certainly internally within the Secretariat. Mm-hmm. You know, the Global Fund was birthed out of the WHO. When it was started, all the staff were actually WHO staff under a contract agreement with the WHO. And that was, you know, that was well needed. We needed to get going fast. There just wasn't time to kind of set up a whole independent thing. So WHO stepped in to help. But it also brought with a little bit of kind of the approach to, you know, the world that can happen when you're in a very large bureaucracy. So then when they emerged and attained sort of fully independent status, some of that kind of came with a bit of a hangover. Mm-hmm. But I think even more importantly, you know, the Global Fund was set up to promote a response that went beyond government. Joanne, you raised this around the kind of the multilateral approach. and said it's tried to focus on not only governmental grantees but also non-governmental grantees, and a significant portion of the funds, you probably know the percentage, are actually managed by non-governmental grantees. Now, whether or not enough of those are faith-based organizations, that's a very legitimate discussion. But I also say that's still a work in progress, you know, and there are still substantive questions around, you know, what's the most sustainable response. So in some cases, supporting NGOs is a way around governments that are weak. Mm-hmm. But the challenge is to invest in a sustainable response. You ultimately depend on governments to meet the needs of their people. The countries that are most affected by these three diseases have to rely primarily on their own governments to be the leaders and in many cases the primary investors in the response. And so you're challenged to figure out how much do you work around a challenged government and how much do you invest in them. And this is where I see the complementarity between PEPFAR and the Global Fund, because I think PEPFAR has in many ways been able to demonstrate a much faster, tougher, stronger, better administered response. But in many cases, it's also done that by working around governments. And I think, you know, there's a kind of a meeting that needs to happen where the Global Fund still needs to probably do a better job around supporting non-governmental groups while investing in governments. And PEPFAR needs to figure out how to build a more sustainable response so it can back out of some countries and put the burden for managing the response where it belongs, which is on the governments of the countries that are most affected.
Yeah, and we don't disagree that transitioning to local entities is not important. It is extremely important, and the design of a lot of the work that we've done is to do just that. But this giving capacity and building that and giving technical assistance and having it there does not exist on the ground that we see in respect to the Global Fund, and it needs to be strengthened in some way, and sure, PEPFAR can help. But I think that this rush to transition from bilateral to multilateral is not in anyone's best interest on the ground that are receiving services. I think we need to take it a little more slowly and more carefully and see that the reforms that are actually happening with the Global Fund stick. And that's just an activist speaking. So.
I was going to say, in some ways, I feel like the good news, you know, in a way that Congress responded in saying, we need to do both. Mm-hmm. You know, even in a challenged budget, you know, that we need to actually scale up funding for the Global Fund and we need to really maintain the support for PEPFAR and you know, supporting for PMI. So in a sense, I think it really is both. And how do those partners and the, you know, the technical partners really support even smarter work on the ground? You know, I'd say that. And also, it feels as if we have to wrestle with the very challenges you're both laying out, but that I think you spoke to, Todd, about how do we work with and really strengthen governments and governments working with non-governmental actors. And this is actually the direction PEPFAR is also looking to move. It's the direction a lot of bilaterals are. So in many ways, I feel like some of the challenges the Global Fund is wrestling with and that we've talked about, and the whole world is wrestling with, and a lot of bilaterals are. So we actually have to get this right because it's sort of where we need to go in order to have real sustainability.
We agree, but sustaining both, to me, is not suggesting a $500 million cut to PEPFAR in the administration's budget. Too.
Yeah, that was
we're going to get to that in just a minute, because that's a whole important topic that we're going to come to focus on. Do you have one thing on this? Because we also have several technical questions to people who might know answers about some of the transition that I want to get out, and then I want to turn to the U.S. and PEPFAR.
I was going to follow up on the whole question around why is Congress stepping forward in this way, and what does this mean?
Yeah, we're going to get there because I think we're all want to talk about that because it's, you know, if you weren't in it, you would not predict that this would be the case. And I think it's a pretty and sort of all the things that are happening in that. A couple of technical questions just to follow up that as you both were speaking about some of the changes, we got a couple questions about the Affordable Medicines Facility. We got what's going to happen to that. We got a question about really will there be enough funding for the transitional mechanism to support everything. So can you just, to the extent the answers are known for those things, they came from Johns Hopkins University, I believe.
Sure. The quick answer is that on the Affordable Medicines Facility for Malaria, sorry, it's hard to say that. I'm only speaking acronyms now in my life. So the AMFM was a pilot effort that's hosted by the Global Fund. That's the phraseology that worked politically. So this is an effort to try to stimulate uptake of the most current medicines, the artemisinin-containing combination therapies, or ACTs, through the private sector, which, in addition to faith community, many countries, the private sector, including faith communities, is the primary area where people go to get health care, including antimalarials. And that can be anywhere from private clinics to those little private drug kiosks that are ubiquitous. And the AMFM tried to essentially use the private sector as a vehicle to expand access by subsidizing the prices of these ACTs to the point where they were cost competitive with the old medicines that no longer work, in a way to try to drive them out of the market. So it was an experiment. Mm-hmm. It was only available to a limited number of countries. I think there are 8 countries that are participating, although Tanzania has its separate grant for Zanzibar, so they kind of sometimes appear as their own country. The program's first phase is coming to an end. The board has a working group that's been established to come up with recommendations later this fall as to what to do going forward. Mm-hmm. I would guess that we're going to come out by saying that we've learned a lot through this process, and we've learned that in some places, under some circumstances, this is a smart approach, but in other places, it's not. And we should be, in many places, really escalating access to those diagnostics for malaria that I mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. And so we're not spending a lot of money on treating people for malaria that don't have malaria.
Yeah, in some ways it's exciting because the success of the response has kind of gone forward so fast that it's rethinking how to more strategically use the AMFM in specific places.
Right. So we're trying to figure out if the board decides to do something differently or discontinue the AMFM in its current form, how do you make sure the countries don't suffer? So that's certainly an active part of the conversation. So I'd expect that in some countries they'll transition out of using the AMFM, and we'll try to figure out how to keep them held harmless in terms of the finances so that they can spend the money on the diagnostics or on the ACTs where people have it. Around the transitional financing mechanism, we have a pretty strong assurance now that we have enough resources that are otherwise uncommitted to fund every application that the TRP approves. We have enough to fund every proposal that came through, and it's unlikely the TRP approves or recommends approval of all of them, although we do expect a much higher rate than a typical funding round. So I think it was $600 million thereabouts. Yeah. I think we should be assured that if they put in a good proposal, they'll get funding. And frankly, under the new strategy, there's even a little bit of opportunity to go back and forth. So if the proposal wasn't perfect and there's questions, there's more of a chance now to go back and forth with the country to make sure that funding doesn't suffer because the proposal was weak.
And maybe just to add, just because it's a that in addition to the at least the latest estimates that will be continued to be sort of reassessed, but the latest estimates on in terms of the resource forecast. And the reason that we made this plan to kind of look to turn the tap back on for new funding in the fall is that the estimates show not only are they going to be able to fully fund this transitional funding mechanism, but that there's about an additional $1.3 billion available. Mm-hmm. Now, $500 million of that is being held in reserve pretty conservatively, but I think that's pretty good news. And that does not include the U.S. top-up, and it doesn't include increased funding from the U.K. So there actually is room to do at least some of the things that we need to do in this next year.
Okay, thanks. So let's go to the U.S. specifically, and I'm going to let Steve take it first. But just to sort of paint that picture, the U.S. is clearly its largest donor to the Global Fund. It helped start the Global Fund. I mean, it was an original architect of it, first pledge, et cetera. It's the largest donor to AIDS, HIV in the world, second largest to TB and malaria behind the Global Fund. So in a sense, it's the largest there probably. It's always been the largest donor of the Global Fund throughout the Global Fund's history. And there's always been a relationship between the bilateral and Global Fund. But something has shifted, right? The discussion has shifted, the perception, and some of the funding allocations. And what's interesting is that under the Obama administration's strategy around global health initiative and more broadly, there's been an increased emphasis on multilaterals. I wasn't sure, others weren't, if that would mean funding distribution, but it seems like it's leading in that direction. In the most recent budget request, we saw that the most starkly. But preceding that, the multi-year pledge that the administration made was the first, I think, multi-year pledge that was ever made, really, in that kind of environment. Usually multi-year pledges aren't made by the U.S. government. So that signals something. And then coming forward and saying in this...
The second after Gavi.
Oh, right. Second after Gavi. So that came first. So both of those signaling the same thing, that the U.S. for the first time was saying, we're going to make these multilateral pledges. We know Congress has to appropriate the money, but to put that marker out there, and then in the most recent budget request to say we're going to meet those, at least that's the request. But as Shepard already mentioned, is starting to come out saying we're going to reduce bilateral HIV by 500-something million, which has caused a lot of concern and questions. And there's been many discussions about this. Malaria, bilateral, and TB went down a little bit as well. And it just raised a lot of questions about, is that shift too fast? Is it too much? How does it fit into the AIDS-free generation concept? And then since then, we've had Congress react to it. And as Steve started to say, the reaction to Congress is probably not what everyone expected. I think there's differences in how Congress wants to balance the bilateral and the multilateral between the Senate and the House. But it's, I mean, please let talk about it. I mean, I think it's really, we're at an interesting moment. I'd like to also then have Shepard talk about it because we've talked and it's definitely a challenging situation.
First thing I'd say is, this is a complicated question with no clear answer, and I'll say what I think some of the answers may be. It's made more difficult by the fact that the administration has not really clearly explained these actions that have been taken. So it's not like there's a vision out there that says we're moving from A to B. What we know is that we have a contracting base pool of dollars available for either purpose. We know that there is a de facto marriage of PEPFAR and Global Fund programs, particularly around HIV, AIDS, and TB. And in order to hit targets and win compliance in Congress with these, they're becoming much more tightly integrated and under much greater... So there is a blurring of the bilateral-multilateral line, and there's a de facto marriage that is happening. It hasn't been articulated very well, but there's also an effort at reorienting money in order to hit treatment targets and some of the other targets in a more strategic way. We know that on the Global Fund, they've done a very, very good job here in Washington on the advocacy side. We know there's a certain measure of continuity and vitality to bipartisan support up on the Hill that has worked to their favor. We know that there is a shift to multilateralism. Some of that is motivated, I think, by an effort to try and free up more resources on the bilateral side within our foreign aid envelopes so that we can do other things for the future. This administration came in with a broader view on that. They recognized the value of the PEPFAR inheritance, but they were looking to find ways to create better sharing of burdens. Multilateral instruments are ways that you can begin to go and leverage greater commitments from your partner countries and greater commitments from other donors and market that back to Congress in the midst of our own budget crisis, which is weighing very heavily, and in the midst of pressure upon getting money for the Middle East North Africa program and for climate change and for water and food security and all the other competitive issues that there are constituencies saying, wait a second, we can't allow all of our budget to get swallowed by these, but we need a strategy to be responsible and have a long-term vision. But as I said at the outset, no one sat down and said, here's the vision. So you're left to speculate about a combination of factors that are shaping this change. And I think I've hit most of them, but probably not all of them.
Yeah. And well, another piece to throw into that is the Global Health Initiative, and that needs clarification as well. The administration didn't go to the Congress to make clear what that would be, and it has great value. I think Lois Quam has done an excellent job for what she's had, but we need that to be part of the mix, and it isn't right now. I think that people on the Hill that we talk to are concerned. I think a lot of people are surprised at the numbers that have come out of the House and Senate for the Global Fund, and it's a pretty tenuous time. Money is tight, and if there isn't some real proof in the pudding that these changes and reforms are occurring, And that there is what Steve's saying about clarity on transition and what the different roles are, you know, it could go the other way in just a year or two. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So. There's one very important point that I didn't make, which is that there's a recognition, a sort of widely shared recognition, that U.S. national interests cannot afford to see the Global Fund fail. And so the interdependence of the bilateral investment with the multilateral investment is understood as a strategic factor. And second is, when we have gone to the fund with fairly tough-minded requests for reforms, we've gotten answers that have satisfied us. And that dynamic, it's not just what happened in April when Gabriel Jaramillo was here. He was coming on the heels of multiple periods in which the Hill has said, we want to see A, B, C, and D. And because we are such a vital contributor and Congress has been hands-on and engaged, that there has been a pattern of trust and credibility built up that allows for this sort of thing. The third very important factor is the presidential hands-on commitment. It's difficult to overestimate the power when President Bush gave his January 2003 State of the Union address launching PEPFAR. That was profound. Mm-hmm. When the president decides to step forward and say, $4 billion, 3 years, this is a priority, it moves the most powerful agency of the U.S. government into a strategic position, and a bunch of other things become possible. And those factors are very important in understanding what's happening here.
Yeah, can I go to Shepard? I want to comment on something you said earlier around kind of the challenges of the Global Fund, and they're real. I mean, I spent a lot of time kind of in dialogue as we were working to develop this new strategy, a lot of over 700 people in, you know, different settings. And we heard a lot of complaints around the operation. Some of them hopefully will be addressed through some of these reforms. But it goes back to the earliest days of the Global Fund, when it was being set up and how it was being set up.
Right.
In this expectation that the Global Fund would literally be a check-writing instrument that would just flow money to countries, and that the technical support necessary to make sure that those monies were used effectively would be provided by the bilateral and the multilateral partners. And so the Global Fund was kind of there with kind of no instrumentality to actually affect the success of its grants. And I think that, you know, then you look at the Global Fund and say, well, it failed, but what does that mean? I think it means that we collectively failed. It means that DFID and USAID and GTZ and others failed because they committed to make sure that the Global Fund monies worked well, and in many cases they didn't. And you go to the field and you see people from the U.S. kind of pointing to that Global Fund over there and all its problems. You're like, well, a third of the money that's sitting there failing is U.S. taxpayer money, so you better get on the go. I think Eric Goosby, head of the PEPFAR program, has done a remarkable job, and Mark Dybul before him had started this, certainly, but, you know, really tried to increase the expectation that the country teams working on PEPFAR would view Global Fund success in their countries as part of their jobs, and that the country operational plans and other aspects by which they would be judged were really part and parcel, and so not just pay attention to the bilateral, but your job is to make sure the Global Fund works as well as it can. They've hired 15 or some odd Global Fund liaisons. They've got Michael Johnson, an experienced physician, working full-time in Geneva just to facilitate this connection. I think they've really stepped up. I think, you know, we need to put more pressure on others who have that bilateral capacity to step up. And we need to put more pressure on WHO and UNAIDS to do a better job around working with countries, and in particular making some of the tough decisions around what's a smart investment and what's not.
And I would only add, I mean, I know that we've all alluded to a lot of the challenges. But again, I want to come back to, you know, some evidence based. So when we're talking about failures, you know, there's certainly been failures in some countries. There have been failures of just money moving more slowly than it could, you know, that could have had even more impact. But again, sort of weighing the evidence of impact on the ground, and admittedly, that impact, you can't even really necessarily completely tease it out from the partners, nor should you. But impact on the ground, so kind of compared to what? Some bilateral programs that have given budget support and you can't find out where it went at all. You know, the World Bank's own internal evaluation of its Africa programs and health from 1997 to 2007, where they found like 75% of them failed on their own you know, evaluation. So I think, I mean, I'm not trying to compare to other donors, but to just say the impact on the ground, despite the challenges of everything that you mentioned, is like, I just want to come back to some of that. And then to the point of, I think one of the other things that a bit has driven the, I think Congress has kind of come up with a really good way forward, which is do both, right? And I mean, and I think that has to be the answer. But part of it is not just that, you know, PEPFAR, PMI, the sort of TB technical support we provide things the Global Fund doesn't, but also that the Global Fund is a platform on which those things are assumed to function. Like PMI, they're assuming they're going to have Global Fund money to do what they do. You know, it's true even of PEPFAR, and it's certainly true of TB programs. So in some ways, there is that marriage that you talked about. They're so interlinked in terms of what they need to deliver together. The sort of estimates are there's a lot that U.S. bilateral programs can deliver, but they almost can't do them without that sort of broader base of support.
It is really a shame, though. I think Steve made a great point around the lack of kind of standing behind the budget with a vision. And I think that that incorporating that with a better more fully articulated vision for Global Health Initiative is part and parcel to that, right? Mm-hmm. So part of GHI was around using U.S. political muscle to sort of engage these countries more and to sort of raise expectations around a mutual response, shared responsibility, putting some of the big policy barriers, human rights barriers on the table, putting more money on the table. Mm-hmm. I just sat through a review of some of the Phase 2 grants. This is the second part of some of the grants. And unlike the new grants, we have $8 billion of renewals coming through over the next couple of years. So there's a big chunk of change coming through. Mm-hmm. I was reading Nigeria. Nigeria is, you know, ground zero for all three diseases, but for malaria, it's massive. It's a third of child deaths from malaria happen in Nigeria. Mm-hmm. And I'm reading the review, and it's like, what's the federal government's contribution? 4%. Mm-hmm. What are the states contributing? Zero. Mm-hmm. And that's simply not acceptable, and it ought not be acceptable to the U.S. to the point where the U.S. ambassador raises it at the highest levels of the Nigerian government. And we are not there to put money into a fight where you're not fully engaged. So we have to figure out together how to do that. We're not going to step back because it's too important. Nigeria cannot fail. But it's more important that you and the governors of those states put more on the table in terms of political leadership and money. And that's where GHI expressed his vision that so far has not been fully evident.
And unfortunately, Nigeria is not the best example of the expenditures of the Global Fund money either, and the scandals that arose, and followed by the fix giving more money to the government, and apparently not learning a lesson. So we agree that we've got to do a lot to support the governments, but how we make sure that the monies are maximized so that the most people can benefit from these dollars. In comparison right now, PEPFAR does so much better than the Global Fund, and it's not fixed yet, and we have to do a lot more reform.
Yeah, Steve.
I just want to use one other case to illustrate the complexity, I think, of this bilateral and multilateral, which is Ethiopia. When you look at Ethiopia, the Global Fund made its biggest commitment globally, any country, to Ethiopia, $1.3 billion. There's now new announcements coming forward this month that will add probably another $400 million, $450 million. In terms of PEPFAR program, a massive investment, $1.7 billion over the last, since 2004. And what has happened recently? What's happened is, both entities have come to the conclusion that they have pipeline problems and they're oversubscribed, but they have to stay in the game in a significant way because there are still things, still many important things to do, but they want to, in the case of USG, scale down the long-term commitments. In the case of the Global Fund, also scale down some of their commitments and reorder them. And an awareness that they have to be much more tightly integrated with one another, that the in terms of the point Todd was making, we have a large, very competent AID, PEPFAR, CDC team in Addis Ababa that its expertise, oversight, and the like needs to be much more carefully leveraged around those Global Fund programs. So today, what are we seeing happen? We're seeing the Global Fund portfolio managers coming in repeatedly over the spring for very intensive planning and deliberations with the U.S. mission. And we're seeing major decisions made about scaling down and refocusing both programs and marrying them up in a way that has not existed before. That's a smart way forward. You're going to get better bang for your buck from both dollars, sort streams. You're going to be putting fewer aggregate dollars out and getting better results. And the dollars that you're pulling out are going to go to places that have higher burden or better demand on that. And that's, I think, illustrative of where we are. That's very illustrative, I think, of where we are today in this.
We actually got a question about Kenya from that same. I think looking at the question, it was about PEPFAR providing so much of the AIDS budget for the country, not its own government. And now it's one of the countries that has, because of pipeline issues, a similar phenomenon is going to go on. And so I don't know if anyone wants to speak to if a similar strategy is already occurring in Kenya around that transition, but I think it raises the same point. If there are legitimate issues to reorganizing or reprioritizing funds, what does it do to affect, how do you make that transition effectively? How do you bring in the global fund and bring in the bilaterals at the same time?
Well, there is a challenge because Nigeria is a bad example, but it's also for that reason it's a good example, right? Because you can't succeed in fighting these three diseases and getting a handle on the big numbers without Nigeria succeeding.
Sure.
So all the complexity and challenges in Nigeria are something that somehow or another we got to pull people together, like is happening in Ethiopia, and just figure that out. Mm-hmm. Kenya is a country that for, I think, something like 8 or 9 rounds failed to get a malaria grant approved. And no one argues that they don't have a problem with malaria or HIV, but it was this kind of, pass-fail competitive system that we had in the past, which hopefully we'll no longer see, but really resulted in this in them not getting an adequate apportionment. So the Ethiopias and the Rwandas, the Tanzanias, that have done really well getting Global Fund resources, they've figured out how to write good proposals. They've done a pretty good job with implementation. Ethiopia's been particularly creative around using funds to build a community-based health response that is probably a really good example for others to follow. Those are good examples, but in many ways, because of the way we've been operating the Global Fund in the last 10 years, those countries have almost been overfunded. And I say that with caution, because Ethiopia is still a desperately poor country, and there's still need there. But proportionally to other countries, they've done better than the Kenyas have and other countries. So somehow the Global Fund's going to have to figure out how to make this happen. The last point I want to make, come back to this tension in Congress, which is where we were. It's really unfortunate that this happened in the context of taking money from one and potentially giving it to another, which is the hydraulic that certainly appeared in the budget, as opposed to a more thoughtful expression of how do you make this mutual relationship smarter and integrate better. And I think it's a testament to the fact that, Steve, you put it well, we're struggling over a smaller pie. And we have to do a better job around figuring out how to just convince policymakers and the citizens behind them that we can't fight these diseases when the resources that we need are dwindling, even as the opportunities sort of sit there waiting for a good, smart investment.
Several of our questions were about that issue. And with the budgets, I mean, we went from a decade of this to now this and maybe a little bit of this efficiency. And how do you get that efficiency without affecting outcomes, but in a negative way. Steve, you wanted to jump in on
just on the Kenya question.
Yeah.
The story that tells is quite different from Ethiopia, right? I mean, you have a split and dysfunctional government. You don't have a unitary vision as you have in Ethiopia,
right.
With a very strong government putting 15% of its budget behind health in Ethiopia. Mm-hmm. Instead, you have a split government that's incoherent, that's not making those sort of commitments. You haven't had the fund take off. I mean, it's the opposite experience from Ethiopia. And on the USG side, on the Global Health Initiative in Kenya, the mission there acquitted itself very, very well in terms of stretching and integrating and taking its PEPFAR program and building in new objectives around maternal and child health and greater integration. But it was oversubscribed relative to the HIV/AIDS burden in that country, and so it's taking, and it had a huge pipeline for a bunch of reasons. And so the scale down of the PEPFAR program in Kenya is the largest of any country. But there's a scale down going on in Ethiopia too, which is significant. But it's in a different context. You're
in
not
South
having
Africa.
The same kind of
South Africa.
You're not having the same kind of smart and integrated process that you can identify in Ethiopia. You don't see that yet in the Kenya context.
Just another key step, I think, to kind of get to this sort of smart, like how we're working together, but also how are we identifying the demand and the opportunities that are there, as well as the sort of overlaps or inefficiencies, but also the demand and opportunities, and really seeing, because, you know, again, Todd, you started out in a really powerful way talking about what the new data show us, what the new tools are. Mm-hmm. And so there's a sort of, you know, challenges of making sure that the different donors and the governments work together, that the government does its fair share, that we're actually, you know, not doubly investing, that we're smartly investing, but at the same time, we have these sort of massive opportunities, like with the new TB tools for the first time ever, you know, in 100 years, and, you know, the data on HIV. Mm. So one of the things that came out of the board meeting in Ghana and then was reiterated again in May was the need and the value to do these kind of real needs assessment at country levels, especially for the highest, at least to start with the highest burden countries, and say, like, what's really, like, what's already there? What's everybody doing, the country and the donors? Like, what smartly needs to happen for the epidemics, but also, like, what are the opportunities? And I think we have to not only kind of look to where we find efficiencies, we absolutely have to do that, but we have to figure out some way to identify and put in a queue the actual opportunities and demands that are there. Because I am absolutely not pessimistic that, I mean, I get where we are at this political moment, but I actually see, given the successes, there's almost nothing we're investing in that's having more success that we can actually scale up resources more. But we're not going to be able to do that if we don't actually, you know, make sure the demand is really smart, but then queue it up and be able to show the world actually what's needed and what a smart plan would look like, and leverage increased country investment for, you know, from the countries themselves. I mean, we also have this moment when some of the G20 countries have sort of are no longer getting global fund money, others won't. So in some ways, we are also freeing up resources. I mean, I think that there's sort of other trends that are happening that could allow things. And just in the context of that, too, I think we need to be smart about how do we keep the global fund global while at the same time focusing resources on the highest burden countries.
I think it's interesting that if you think about the global fund is now looking at a priority set of highest need countries to put most of its energy. And PEPFAR is also kind of going back a little bit in that direction. We had focus countries in PEPFAR 1 under President Bush, and so the idea was let's expand. But I think now it's with budgets changing and also learning more, it's how do you best match those things? You wanted to say something.
Just to maximize dollars and to guarantee sustainability, I'd really like to see the Global Fund embrace the faith community much more than it has, and that'll make a big difference.
I would really hope that we figure out how to make these smart investments. I think if you look at where the Global Fund is on a regional basis in proportion to disease burden, it's amazingly connected, even though it's been a very passive instrument. I mean, the Global Fund is one of the most passive funding instruments ever. So Ethiopia being oversubscribed is literally just a function of, you know, the Global Fund taking technically sound proposals and just writing checks.
And a lot of ambition by the government.
And a lot of ambition by the Ethiopian government. Mm-hmm. But the challenge is to figure out how do we look at the portfolio both regionally but within the region. So I think that regionally we're not far off. We don't have to move a lot of money out of Latin America and Eastern Europe in order to do the right thing by Southern Eastern Africa. Most of the money is already there. I think that within the region there are some anomalies. We have countries that have done really well by the Global Fund and some that have not done near well enough. And those we had to figure out. And then even within the countries, we have some work to do. And the Nigeria, it's a giant, 140, 150 million people with a lot of different states and a lot of different disease burdens. We have to figure out kind of how to, even within those big countries, move the money more smartly. And then within the diseases, you know, how much do you want to put into bed nets, how much into ACTs for treatment, how much into residual spraying to keep the mosquitoes away from homes, all those kinds of things. There's a balancing that needs to go on and a smarter approach. Ultimately, coming up with that approach and making it fit the disease epidemic, the unique epidemic in each one of those countries, is up to their governments. And we got to turn the heat on to expect them to do a better job of developing smart strategies, putting their own money and political muscle on the table, and then using the U.S. dollars, either through multilateral or bilateral, to support that, not to lead.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. You know, we're actually running out of time, so I think you're helping us move to sum some of this up or at least lay out some future thoughts, and I want to turn to others on that too. You know, it's interesting. You were talking about the balancing that needs to happen and where you put your interventions, and that can't happen in the absence of bilateral donors, right? Because if PEPFAR or PMI are rebalancing their portfolios on interventions, it has to be done in coordination. Mm-hmm. You know, thinking ahead a little bit, near term and far term or midterm. I was, you know, the International AIDS Conference is around the corner, closer than we all probably realize at this point. There's going to be a lot of eyes in the U.S., and is that an opportunity here to talk about some of this and the relationship? You know, interestingly, we poll the public on their views on global health, and one of the things we asked in our recent poll that just came out was, is the public more likely to support the approach of the U.S. going on its own bilaterally, which allows more control, accountability, and I guess, measurement, or go with others, contribute to multilateral organizations, which allow, you know, brings in others and leverages U.S. dollars. The U.S., almost two-thirds support the go with others, which is interesting. Now, mm-hmm. And we mentioned the Global Fund, and we tested that, so they support that concept. But translating that to Congress, translating that to the other actors, and is an ongoing issue. So just in the near term, if anyone wants to think about the conference coming up and then a little bit beyond, where, you know, what can we think about in a couple of words going forward? I'll start with Joanne.
You know, I think one of the things I said before, which is how do we get really the key actors, which are the countries, folks like PEPFAR, the Global Fund, PMI, and others, together really doing, like, this is a moment of both, you know, challenge, but also, like, optimism about where the epidemics could go. I think if we sat down and really look at country level in these countries and see, like, what's possible and what's needed and what's already happening, like, to move that forward through the AIDS conference, I mean, it's a bit of a technical thing, but I think it also is an advocacy moment, an advocacy tool. Like, let's figure that out, because that will show us actually what's really possible. And then just a sort of piece we just haven't actually mentioned is innovative financing. So right. I don't think the doors are closed. You know, challenges with that too, especially when you talk about the Eurozone. But I mean, France is talking now about a mini financial transaction tax, and part of that could go to global health. So, you know, I think we have to think creatively also about what are ways forward as well as the kind of straight budgets.
Thank you. For AIDS 2012, relative to the Global Fund, a couple of things. The fund itself is not all that well understood among a broad American public. The conference allows a couple of things. It allows for the possibility of major leadership from Africa and other countries coming forward and talking about this to an American public that will listen, and they will have credibility. Yeah. Okay, that is very important. Right. It's very important that the spirit and tone of this conference be one that is affirmative around the achievements that have been made through these investments, and that those achievements are articulated, and the vision looking forward in terms of what you were all saying about the science and the prospects for major gains. The conference is going to be beset by two contrary poles. One is going to be this optimism and this hubris and hope around what can be done in the near term. The other is going to be the angst as Europe is melting down, and our own budget, and we're going to, in the middle of our own very polarized political process, and everyone understands that come December and January, our own budget reckoning will be fully upon us, and that is going to pose questions. And, you know, when we to bring back to sort of the fund itself, money is going to be a critical question looking forward about what money is possible and feasible. The politics around the place is going to be very fundamental around making sure that we are talking in the right terms about this and we don't get into squabbles with the French or others, and making sure that the next board director, the next executive director is out there selected on a very clean process that is not an ugly squabble, and which gets the right person up and running. We've seen how high-impact Gabriel Jaramillo has been, and we need the next person coming forward in a timely way to convince people around that. Thank you.
Sure. So we're out of time, and I'm going to give you the last word, Shepard.
Excuse me.
I think when you look at the history of the AIDS conferences, they have been a platform for activists to demand more money, and we really need to see a change, I think, in respect to an acknowledgement that we need to be smarter in what we do with our resources. because it is going to be a tough few years ahead financially, and that thinking of the AIDS community really needs to change, and we all need to work together, including the faith community.
Absolutely.
All right.
All right. Our time is up. I'd first like to thank our panelists, Joanne Carter, Steve Morrison, Shepard Smith, and Todd Summers for being here and sharing your views with us. And to our audience, I'd like to thank all of you for your questions. On our website, globalhealth.kff.org, you'll find additional resources on today's In Focus. And we encourage you to share the video and transcript with your own audiences. We also hope that you will join us for future webcasts of U.S. Global Health Policy In Focus. I'm Jed Cates of the Kaiser Family Foundation. Thank you.